Hello there, am I on? Very warm welcome to everyone to St Peter's Barge and to this special event we've got going today. Well done for noticing the time. I know we're 10 minutes earlier than when we normally have our lunchtime talks, so well done for noticing. There may be a little cruise in at 15:15, which is when we normally meet. It's a great honour to and joy to be able to welcome our visitor today, Billy McCurry. He's come down from Liverpool to be with us. Billy's going to share with us. I'm going to interview him, and he's going to say something about his life story. And then afterwards, just at the end, I'm going to pull the strands together, and I'm going to speak for 10 minutes just to bring out some of the implications of what Billy's said. So without further ado, can I invite you, Billy, up? Welcome.
Thank you.
Please take a seat. Billy, but you haven't said much, but we're going to discover in a moment you're not really from Liverpool, are you? Where is your accent from?
From Belfast, as you gather. I'm not a native of Liverpool. Been living in England for 14 years now. 14 years next month. And from Belfast, East Belfast originally.
Okay, and so you would have grown up in the 60s and the 70s in Belfast, which, if we know much about Northern Ireland, would have been a pretty lively time. Is that right?
Yeah, I think Belfast, like most of the cities in the UK, 60s particularly, with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and that whole pop culture. I had an older brother and an older sister who... older brother was into the Rolling Stones, and the younger and an older sister was into the Beatles. So I had the both sides as I was growing up. It was a very happy home. I had a younger sister also. My dad was a labourer. Lived in a just two-up, two-down house at the bottom of the Newton Arch Road in the shadow of Harland and Wolff. And it was a very, very happy upbringing.
Yeah, and I guess we know it was a very religious place, Northern Ireland. Was it a religious home?
It wasn't a particularly religious home. My dad didn't really have much time for God. He was he went into Belsen 3 days after it was liberated, and he said that removed God from the equation for him when he saw the horrors of Belsen. So I was sent to school, a Sunday school, like most young kids in East Belfast, but it wasn't a particularly religious home, a happy home.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And
not saying that religion isn't a happy thing.
Maybe we'll come on to that in a bit. Actually, could you just put your mic up a little bit? We've got a bit of feedback. So we're getting this picture of a happy home, but it didn't stay happy for the whole childhood. Can you tell us, is it something happened to you?
Yes, at the age of 12, 1968-69. The trouble started in the province. Most people, I think, at that time thought it would last maybe 6 months, 18 months, and then peter out as it had done in the past. But Saturday the 27th of June 1970, if I had time this afternoon, I could take you through practically each step that I had with my dad that day. It was a day like this. It was a glorious, glorious summer's day. And that night, my dad wasn't the first civilian to be shot dead. He was among one of the first civilians to be shot dead. That night, Saturday the 27th of June, he was coming home from a social club, and he was shot dead by the IRA. I was 12 at the time. And practically overnight, that family that had been united in love and happiness found itself united in sorrow and grief. It had a devastating effect on my home life.
And few of us could imagine quite what that would do to a young life. What impact did it have on your family or on you personally?
On the whole family, after my dad was killed so tragically by as a result of terrorism, my family do not have a monopoly on violence. I know that, you know, many, many families have been touched as a result of the madness of terrorism in north and south of Ireland, as well as on the mainland here. People react differently when it comes to their doorstep. And when violence came to my own doorstep, the whole family was really immersed in such an intense bitterness. I couldn't begin to explain to you just how bitter we became. how that bitterness grew, how it was fed and fueled by the ongoing terrorist campaign, how it was fueled when my mother was 3 months pregnant at the time. My dad was killed 6 months later to the day my kid brother was born. I can still remember him as a little boy running in off the street, running up to my mum and asking what a daddy was. How come his friends had a daddy to talk about and he hadn't? Where was his daddy? And to see my mum break down in tears, trying to explain to him why there was no daddy in the home, fueled that hatred, fueled that bitterness. And I wanted revenge. I had an insatiable longing for revenge.
Okay, so we've got a picture of this family, this 12-year-old boy. I guess when you're 16, was it, you signed up for a paramilitary
organization? That's right.
Organization?
At the age of 16, I went out of my way to join a loyalist terrorist group. It was expected of most fellas, whether they were from a loyalist or Republican background, and particularly in working class areas, that they would be involved in some way or other. And I volunteered my services, and I volunteered to go into the organisation, not just to make up the numbers, but I say it much to my shame today, I went into that organisation to kill as many people as possible.
And it didn't take long in the organisation before your hopes were realised. So explain what happened and how it caught up with you.
Yeah, I was asked to take part in the shooting in Belfast. That was on the 19th of February, 1976. Volunteered to do that, wanted to prove myself within the organisation. There was no remorse, no regret, no conscience over my action. I had proved myself with that first killing, and now I was going to go on a killing spree. But thankfully, by the grace of God, I recognise that now. 2 weeks after that, I was arrested and found myself in the Maze prison. The Maze was opened in 1971, first as an internment camp, and then after internment was phased out and the troubles continued, it really was used to hold people who were arrested for terrorist-related crimes. Massive prison, it was the largest prison in Western Europe at that time. And that's where I found myself at the age of 17.
And what was your experience like? I guess you might have been a shock to you going to prison. What was it like when you're actually inside?
It was no shock going into prison because I knew the type of activities I was involved in. I was either going to end up in prison for a long time or end up dead. There was no sense of regret or remorse or shame about ending up in prison. I felt I was there at that time. I felt I was there because I was doing a bit for my country. I was held in a compound that solely held members of my own organisation. The paramilitary groups had practically complete control of the prison, so they were really just being contained. What was a shock to my system was the fact that there was stability in prison. Now, I guess it could only happen in an Irish situation. The place where you would think the conflict would intensify would be the place where the main protagonists are held. But in fact, it was probably the safest place to be in 1970. Because they had thrashed out an agreement. The two opposing sides had thrashed out an agreement. And that was the shock to the system. I wasn't expecting that. Why did the war suddenly stop in prison? And I asked it to a fella one night, why has the war suddenly stopped? And he began to explain, you know, well, when prison first opened, we always went out of this place ready for a fight. But we realised, couldn't go on, got together, thrashed out an agreement. Now, he said, you can leave this compound any time without fearing for your life. You can go down into the visiting area, you can wear your good clothes, go into that visiting room and let your mother see that there's nothing to worry about, that you're okay in this place. And he said to me, this marked a bit of a turning point for a number of years in my life, when my attitudes, values and beliefs were changed. He concluded the conversation by saying that it was no joke sending some mother's son into a visiting room with a black eye. And I was held in a compound with over 100 fellas, and at least 90% of us had sent some mother's son home there in a coffin. And I can guarantee you, for every son we sent home to their mum in a coffin, she would love to have had them with a black eye. She would love to have had that son with a black eye. And if these guys could come to an agreement in prison, there has to be an agreement out of prison. And I went down to a little study of politics then with ample time in my hands. I had no real political awareness before I went into prison. But now with ample time in my hands, and following that remark, I went into a little study of politics. God didn't feature in my life.
And what is it that in the political world was catching your attention?
At that time, it was Marxism. I studied Marxist ideology for a number of years. No difficulty in prison getting books on how to orchestrate a guerrilla warfare. I studied it avidly in prison, how to conduct a guerrilla warfare. And that's what I was dedicating my time to in prison.
And throughout that time, I've heard you speak on this before, you started getting unusual things in the post.
That's
right. Tell us?
Yeah. Around about 1978, after I was sentenced, I was transferred to the H blocks of the Maze Prison. If you're familiar with the Troubles and the history of the Troubles, coming out of the H blocks, you have the blanket protest, dirty protest, and then the hunger strike, which maybe most of you would be familiar with. So I was transferred to the H blocks after I was sentenced, and I was lying in the cell one day. Brown envelope comes through the door. Get off the bed to pick up this envelope, pull out the contents, and I catch the name of Jesus somewhere in the corner. Put it back inside the envelope, curl it up in the ball, and threw it in the waste paper bin. No time for God or religion. And what was remarkable about them, and what I can't give an adequate explanation for even up to the present day, New Zealand postmark, New Zealand stamp. I know nobody in New Zealand, and yet these magazines were coming from New Zealand and were going into the waste paper bin.
So you at least were coming across the name of Jesus, even if slightly randomly.
Yeah, well, could have came from the Mormons or anybody like.
Okay, but did you know any Christians, any believers?
There were some Christian prison officers. There were some Christian prisoners at that time, very few. One of them being a guy called Peter Thompson. Peter was arrested a couple of weeks after me, about a month after me. We came through our remand time together. He was sentenced a matter of weeks after me. And when he arrived in the H blocks, he was carrying a Bible, which I thought was very convenient. You know, he had just been given a life sentence. So he wants out of prison early. And what's the best way to try and get out of prison? Well, show the authorities you've got a wee bit of religion and you're a good guy. And you're carrying a Bible now instead of a bomb. And maybe you'll get out early. So Peter, as far as I was concerned, was a hypocrite. He was a phony. And he wasn't going to pull the wool over my eyes.
Okay, so tell us, we've got this picture of you that studying guerrilla warfare. What happened at that stage that piqued your interest
right.
in Christian things?
Okay. The magazines are coming. I'm throwing them into the bin. Peter Thompson's talking about Jesus. So I thought I would send the magazines to Peter. Still unopened. And one night, I had a really bad headache. I went out to the medical room for headache tablets. Peter was in the medical room. And I said to him, Peter, are you getting the magazines I'm sending across to you? I don't know who's sending them, but Peter, you're quite welcome to them. And the medical officer, he said, do you not think it's God who's sending you these magazines? I mean, have you ever heard anything stupid in your life? God sending magazines from New Zealand to the Maze. And I said to this medical officer, look, I'm skeptical about God. I don't really believe God exists. And I was waiting on him saying, well, you know, you're a fool. The Bible calls you a fool. I was going to throw him a line of argument. Get offside. And he looked at me. And he said, well, I want to tell you something, kid. Regardless of whether you believe in God or not, doesn't take away the fact that there is a God. Nor does it take away the fact that if you die, in the state that you're in at the moment, you're going straight to hell. And once you get there, kid, you're not going to be skeptical anymore. You're going to be a believer. And the tragedy of it is this, that once you're there, there's no release date. You're there forever. I couldn't hit him with a line of argument for, you're a fool. You had wrong foot at me. And hightailed it out of that medical room. And I thought about it. Yeah, if there's a heaven and a hell, there's no argument. I mean, I know where I'm going, but is there a heaven and a hell? You know what religion's right? You know, these Christians are so arrogant, so dogmatic. But a little seed was sown in my mind. Started to ask a lot of questions. What I can't give an adequate explanation for, even up to the present day. Those magazines that have been coming on a regular basis, every 6 or 8 weeks for about 2 years, never received another one of them after that encounter with the medical officer. And it's as weird, it's as freaky as that, isn't it? Like, you know, I like sort of have a lot of answers, but there's no answers for that one. Like,
so suddenly you've got these questions buzzing around your head, but it doesn't sound like you were eager to voice them to Christians particularly. How did you deal with those questions? How did you find answers for them?
Be honest, originally I wasn't seriously wanting answers. It was just trying to be arrogant and throw a spanner into you know, the thinking of these Christians. So whether it was Peter Thompson or another Christian prisoner or a Christian prison officer, I was just throwing out ridiculous questions to them. But God had a way in bringing me to my knees. And that was on the 24th of December 1980, when a woman called Gladys Blackburn came down to my cell. Gladys stood about so high. She was great. Retired school teacher. And she was a member of the Board of Visitors, and she came down to my cell on Christmas Eve 1980.
And you remember the day well. What is it that was significant about that day?
I remember that day well. It was an evening, just before lock-up. She came down to my cell. After a bit of formal conversation, she lifted down the Bible, and she started to read the story of the crucifixion, where Jesus is crucified on either side of the two criminals, or two thieves. Some people think the two first century terrorists. It was from Luke 23. And one of the thieves said unto Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And she stopped and said, "Think who this thief is calling Lord." She began to explain what Jesus must have looked like on the cross. And when she started to read that, and started to explain what Jesus must have looked like on the cross, for the very first time in my life, I felt guilty. I stood in Belfast High Court on the 12th of May, 1977, was sentenced to what amounted to a life sentence, and practically laughed in the judge's face. Man's judgment held no fear for me. When I came face to face with the cross of Christ and the reality of God's judgment, and how Jesus was sinless and he was taking my punishment, I realized that. I knew that I needed that weight of sin. That couldn't put it, wouldn't have phrased it, of sin back then. It was just an overwhelming sense of guilt. How do I get rid of this? Because as the prison officer said, that's actually what was taking me to hell. You know, that guilt. And I asked that woman, "How do you become a Christian?" And she said, "It's as simple as ABC. Accept that Jesus Christ died for you, believe it, and then go out and confess it to others." That was the turning point.
So there and then with her in the room?
No, Gladys, the questions had stopped. Okay. So there was no more questions, there was no more arrogance. There was the overwhelming sense of guilt. I was hanging my head in shame. Gladys left the cell. I remember leaving with, she left me with one verse of scripture, John 6:37, "All that the Father give to me will come to me. And him who comes to me I will never turn away." And that night, Christmas Eve 1980, I got down on my knees in the cell, repented of my sin, asked God to take my life, make something of it. There was no flashes of thunder, flashes of lightning, or funny mystical experience. It was a simple prayer of faith, and God heard it. And my life was transformed.
And you knew that something beautiful had happened into your life, but mm-hmm. that sea confessed. It sounds like from Peter's experience, Christians weren't very popular in the prison. Did you tell anyone?
Well, confession was a bit of a sticking point, because I didn't want... I knew what I thought about Peter Thompson. And people would feel the same about myself. You can't face up to the pressure of the penal system. You need a crutch to lean on. You know, when I became a Christian, God didn't give me a crutch, he gave me a new pair of legs. And the confession bit, you know, how was I going to get around that? Well, next door, the cell next door, was a guy called Michael McGee, and we called him Shirley, because he always gossiped. He was like a woman, you know, just gossiped. Sorry, that's very sexist, isn't it? But, well, you know what I mean. But I knew that Michael, if I told Michael that I was a Christian, he would tell everybody for me. And so that's what I did on Christmas Eve morning. The prison officer opened my door. I was right behind him. And as soon as he opened the door, I shouted into Michael, I became a Christian last night, and then run back into my cell. And see, within 5 minutes, everybody else in the wing, they were either coming in wanting to shake me by the throat. Some of them shook me by the hand and said, really pleased for you, hope you keep it up. Others were coming in and saying, give you a week. After a week, it was give you a month. After a month, it was, when you get out, you'll be back your old ways. That was over 32 years ago.
And it has been quite a change in your life. How did it impact your family? What about your mother?
Yeah, obviously wrote out family and friends, told them what had taken place in my life. My sister, the older sister, she said anything's better than communism. And so, you know, Christianity's just his next phase. It's going to help him through the sentence. My mother, she wrote back a letter and said, you know, how could I talk about a God of love? How could I talk about a God of forgiveness? And I forgot what had happened the night your dad was gunned down in the street like a dog by those IRA scum. You can still see it underlined. And I haven't forgot, you know, 43 years ago this month, and as I say, I can still take you through practically every step of the day that I had with my dad. 43 years, still the questions, still the pain. And certainly I hadn't forgot even back then. And I sat down and wrote her a letter based on Romans 12:19, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. And I sent a covering letter to my sister saying to her, look, go down and get my mum and take her to church with you. And about 2 weeks after that, I got a letter from my mum, and this is how she opened it. I now know what you mean about God's forgiveness. Tonight at church, I became a Christian. And, you know, when I saw my mum saved, I saw a mountain of hatred and bitterness, which had accumulated over 10 years, being removed and being released from that hatred and that bitterness.
And that made a big difference in her life?
An immense difference. When that hatred goes, yeah, I often say to people, I remember my mum as a little boy when she was cleaning the house. She would always sing country songs. That's where I get my love for country music. My mum cleaning and singing. After my dad was killed, she never sang. She said she had nothing to sing about. It was just hate. And then after she became a Christian, you know, she started to sing again. You know, that's what God does. That's what Jesus does. He puts the song back into your broken life.
So we've understood this huge change, and lots of people saying, well, when you come out, it'll all go back to normal. Yeah. Tell us what you were eventually released, we can see.
Yeah, that's right. I was released on December the 8th, 1985, which was a relatively short space of time for the seriousness of the crime. The following year, I went to the Baptist College and studied for the ministry. I mean, I'm a Baptist pastor today, just north of Liverpool. And, you know, people said, as soon as you get out, you'll be back to your old ways. When I came out of prison, I had the same desire that I had in prison after I became a Christian. And that was just a longing to share with people this life-changing, life-transforming message. You know, I started to live in the Mays prison on the 24th of December, 1980.
Great. Well, there's much more it would be good to hear about, and I know there's some great stories after that. I'm conscious of the time constraints we've got. We've actually, if people want to come back, we've got a much longer slot this evening. If you're free, do come back and we'll cover a little bit more ground. But for now, thank you very much, Billy, and I'll send you back to your seat.
Okay. Thank you.
So what am
I'm going to do just as we close is draw some of the strands together that Billy's been talking about and think about the implications for our lives. As you'll remember, the big moment, the big turning point for Billy was that Christmas Eve, Gladys came in and read a text from the Bible, the crucifixion. There were two thieves, and what she did is she showed a glimpse of Jesus, and that glimpse is what transformed Billy. And what I want us to do now is to look at that glimpse of Jesus, to see what Billy saw, to see what we see in that passage that made such a difference. And what she showed and what we see in that text is two things as we look at Jesus. One is the problem of our rebellion, and the other thing is the promise of Jesus' rescue. So first, let's think about the problem of our rebellion. Now, when Gladys was reading, the first bit of that section, we hear about the first criminal who actually started pouring abuse at Jesus. And he started saying this: "Aren't you the Messiah? Why don't you save yourself and us?" And then the other criminal, the other side, he intervenes. He starts telling him off. And he says, "Aren't you afraid of God, even when you're getting the same punishment as he is? And it's fair enough for us, for we've only got what we deserve. But this man never did anything wrong in his life." So we've got these two different responses. I mean, these two guys have actually got a lot in common. Both guilty of crimes, both being executed, both know something about Jesus. But there's something that separates them. And actually, as the passage goes on, we discover that it separates these two men eternally. And what it is that sets them apart is that only one of those men was prepared to acknowledge his own sin, his own guilt before God, his own inadequacy. Now, I'm a clergyman in the Church of England, so I get to go to a few more funerals than most people do. And I get to hear at funerals how most people view life. It's very revealing. And what comes across very strongly is how many people believe that if there is a God, then surely at the end of the day, he must finally accept us. He'll send us to heaven. You know, after all the good stuff we've done, doesn't that count for something? But I guess most of us know, I mean, in other contexts, in legal contexts, life doesn't work like that. You know, I've never heard of a human judge saying, "Well, we find you guilty of these crimes, but as your mother has said, you've occasionally been very kind to her, so we're going to just let it go." I mean, it just doesn't work like that. And it doesn't work like that with God either. Last year, I guess we know that the media was full of all these stories of people falling from grace. Most famously, it was Jimmy Savile, because he was accused of sexual assault. Lance Armstrong, who admitted to illicit drug use. And then there was Joe Paterno, the football coach, who was fired for an abuse cover-up. And one of the things that all of these people had in common was they were really generous people. I don't know if you know this, Armstrong's foundation has raised $300 million for cancer victims. Paterno was also a huge donor. And Jimmy Savile, he's reported at least to have given away nearly 90% of his personal wealth. And one article was noticing this connection between these people. You know, and the article said this: "They think that doing one good big thing cancels out all the little grubby things." And then the article concludes, "Maybe the rest of us are no different." You know, we all have this tendency, don't we, to think if there is a God, surely we can do some good stuff to pay him off, you know, for the wrong things that we have done. But we're mistaken. Now, speaking personally, I've got this this kind of self-righteous tendency to find people in the world who are worse than me. Maybe people in the media, like the ones I've mentioned, maybe people around me. And I use those people, I kind of push them down to prop myself up and to give me my own sense of goodness. You know, at least I'm not like one of them. And perhaps there's some people here who are in your heads, right now you're thinking, "Well, I'm not like Billy McCurry. You know, he might need Jesus rescue, but I'm not like him. I'm not a bad person." I heard a couple of years ago about a group of convicted rapists in Long Bay Prison in New South Wales. And apparently, they all shaved their heads on the same day. Seems a bizarre thing to do. But the reason they did it when they were asked is because all of the sex offenders in that prison are in the same block of the prison. And all these rapists, they really wanted to distinguish themselves, separate themselves from the paedophiles. At least we're not like them. We're not evil. We're not paedophiles. And do you see this kind of twisted logic that human beings use? You know, whatever our lifestyles, whatever we've done, we can always find someone worse than us to condemn. And that makes us feel, well, at least we're okay. But do you see this criminal next to Jesus? He does something very different. So he compares himself, not with the other criminal. He compares himself with Jesus. He realizes that Jesus is the yardstick. Jesus is the benchmark. And he says, we are getting what we deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. You see, Jesus shows us what human beings are supposed to be like. And next to him, all of our claims to be good, all our claims to be worthy, we discover are actually pretty grubby. So you and I guess, haven't done the kinds of things that those criminals on the cross have done. We haven't done, I hope, many of the things that Billy has done. But as we compare ourselves, not with each other, but with Jesus, with that incredible life of love for God and life of love poured out for others throughout his life, we discover, don't we, life as it's meant to be. We discover really the problem of our rebellion. You see, you and I, everyone in this room, everyone in the world, apart from Jesus, we have all rebelled against our Creator. Some of us have done it in very obvious ways, like Billy. Others of us in more subtle, self-justifying, perhaps even religious ways. And yet, as we see Jesus dying on the cross, we see clearly, don't we, the lengths that our Creator has to go to deal with human rebellion. We see the seriousness of our problem. And you'll remember it was seeing that snapshot of Jesus which revealed to Billy for the first time his problem, his accountability before God. Now, if that was all that Billy saw that day in that picture of Jesus, that would be pretty crushing. But thankfully, as we look at Jesus dying on the cross, we also see not just the problem of our rebellion, but we see the promise of Jesus' rescue. So that first criminal, he looks at Jesus and he says this, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now that, as the more we reflect on it, and Billy was mentioning it, it's a bizarre statement. You know, here he is saying to this guy, everything about Jesus' situation seems pathetic, doesn't it? He's an utter failure. All his claims to be God, all his promises that he's going to save the world, they all seem to have come to nothing as his life is just ebbing away. But this criminal can see beyond that, and he can see that Jesus really is God's chosen king, the one predicted in the scriptures. So he says, the one who will come into his kingdom is what he says. And he can see that Jesus' death, far from being the end for Jesus, is actually the accomplishment of all that Jesus had come to do. You see, Jesus' death wasn't a failure. It was a success. He died deliberately, willingly, in our place. In fact, it's at that moment in Jesus' life that something remarkable happens. There's this miraculous exchange, which Billy mentioned. So imagine, if you can, the sin of that criminal. And imagine, if you can, the wrongdoing of each one of us in this room who belongs to Jesus being transferred onto Jesus. So maybe just a few black marks, some stains, just splattered on Jesus. But then huge flakes of sin just encrusting him all over. And just covering him in layers and layers of moral filth. You know, every evil thought, every vile act, every act of betrayal, every cruel word we've spoken, all the greed, all those years ignoring God, all those years blaming God, now just covering Jesus. So all that sickens God in us, now enveloping his son from head to toe. And then now, at that same instant, imagine this. The purity of Jesus lifting and covering the dying criminal. So this sheet of moral radiance just wraps around him. So as God the Father looks down from heaven, he sees his Son covered with the sins of the world. And God's moral outrage, his indignation, is poured out onto Jesus, punishing sin. And then he looks down on the criminal and on us, if we belong to Jesus, and he sees this dazzling purity of his Son in us. We are now his children. The Apostle Paul puts it like this, and Billy quoted this: Jesus, who knew no sin, became sin, so that in Jesus we can be put right with God. And that is why Jesus can say to this guilty criminal as he's dying, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. So this promise of Jesus' rescue, it's incredible, isn't it? Totally certain, totally secure, being with Jesus forever in a recreated universe in paradise. And actually, this promise that Jesus makes to this criminal is open to any one of us. As the criminal shows, you know, being bad doesn't disqualify us. It doesn't shut us out from God necessarily. But as the other criminal shows, if we ignore God's one means of rescue, if we ignore Jesus, that really will shut us out from God. So what we need to do to make this promise ours is barely mentioned, an ABC, easy to remember. So we need to admit the problem of our rebellion before our Creator. We need to believe that Jesus did take our sin, that his promise of rescue is for us. And then see, we need to confess and commit. We need to confess that we belong to Jesus and commit to trusting and obeying him. Now, I'm aware that for lots of us here, this will be radically new to you, and you'll have a dozen different questions rising in your mind. If that is you, on those little blue sheets that you've got on your chairs, there's details of a course that we run here. We kind of run it on a rolling basis. It's a brilliant course. Lots of people have done it. It's called Christianity Explored, and it runs over 3 Monday lunchtimes. You watch a DVD presentation. It goes over the eyewitness testimonies about Jesus, the basics of the Christian faith. And there's a chance to bring any objection, any question. If that's you, I'd really encourage you just to tick the box and sign up for that starting this Monday. It's really great to make the most of that. And otherwise, I guess lots of us here, this is familiar territory. We know, and we know this belongs to us, this promise. And if that is you, as you go out into the sun now, remember to have a spring in your step. It really is the most incredible, wonderful privilege, which is ours. And for each one of us, please do come back next week. As you may know, we do regular Wednesday and Thursday talks, and there's details on the cards about that. And this time next week, we are looking at the topic, how can there be just one true religion? That may be a particular issue for you or for someone you know, so do come back to that. And all it remains for me now is to thank you, Billy, and thank you all very much for coming. And I look forward to seeing you, hopefully, next week. Thank you.